This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. It's you, me, top experts, a meeting room, and 28 minutes. This week, big tech may be in big trouble, with Facebook facing anti-monopoly action in the US. So will Facebook survive? Earlier this month, on the same day, the US government and dozens of state prosecutors filed two of the biggest antitrust cases in US history against Facebook. It's a landmark moment for the company and for the rest of big tech. Giant outfits that have revolutionized our lives have, up until now, been allowed to grow and develop unhindered. So is that all about to change? And will the first victim be Facebook? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, what is the case against Facebook? Gilad Edelman, a writer at Wired magazine who covers tech and politics, has been following it. Gilad, this case against Facebook in the United States, who launched it and why?
There were, somewhat confusingly, two cases filed on the same day against the same company. One case was filed by the Federal Trade Commission, which is the Department of the United States federal government that enforces competition laws. And then a parallel suit was filed by a coalition of 46 states plus two territories. And together, the two suits accuse Facebook of having used anti-competitive tactics to build up a monopoly in social networking. The thrust of the case is that over the years, Facebook used a variety of tactics to build up a monopoly. And it's important to understand that under US competition law, there's a big difference between becoming big purely because you're doing a good job and becoming big by doing things that had no purpose other than crowding out the competition. And so the lawsuits identify several ways in which Facebook is believed to have taken these sort of anti-competitive steps, things that were designed not to improve Facebook as a product, but just to ward off competition. One is acquisitions. So most famously, Facebook bought Instagram and WhatsApp, which were two rising competitors. And there's a lot of internal documentation from Facebook that strongly suggests that the company did this, that Mark Zuckerberg undertook these acquisitions because he wanted to neutralize threats. Another category of allegedly anti-competitive behavior is the way that Facebook has used the data that it can gather on other companies that operate on Facebook's platform to identify which ones are up and comers and come up with ways to kind of squeeze them out.
So that's the first strand, if you like, which is the way in which they have affected the competition, taken over the competition, crowded out the market. And then there is this large second element, isn't there, which is about what the effect has been on the consumer.
Absolutely. And that's another important part because, again, to make an antitrust case successful, the enforcers want to be able to show that this was bad overall. They don't want the company to be able to say, well, sure, we're the biggest player in the market, but that's on balance good for everyone. So that's where privacy comes in. According to these cases, as Facebook grew and grew and took over or forced out more and more of the possible competitors, it was able to backslide on promises it made about user privacy. So if you go back in time to when Facebook first came up, the biggest show in town was actually MySpace. And MySpace was a social network that was kind of notorious for not being great about privacy. Facebook, when it launched, was very different. Your profile was only visible to people at your college. They promised that an early privacy policy said, we do not and will not use tracking cookies. So they made very emphatic representations about how much they would protect user privacy. Today, Facebook tracks you all over the web, even when you're not logged into Facebook. And the theory here is that these two things are not a coincidence. That as Facebook got more and more powerful, it feared competition less and less, and so was able to make changes to privacy that users might not like, but didn't really have any choice over the matter.
So essentially, it used its monopoly position to deteriorate the privacy position of its customers, which it wouldn't have been able to do if it hadn't been a monopoly.
Exactly. And there's this really telling moment from the complaint filed by the coalition of states where Facebook is confronting competition from Google Plus. So Google Plus was Google's ill-fated effort to break into the social networking market. And the complaint includes some pretty striking internal emails. So first, there's one from Sheryl Sandberg, who's Facebook's chief operating officer. And she writes, "For the first time, we have real competition and consumers have real choice. We will have to be better to win." So that's pretty striking right there because it suggests that they were aware that it was sort of unusual for consumers to actually have a choice. And what comes next is even more interesting. So at the same time that they were girding for battle with Google Plus, they apparently were considering taking away your ability to untag yourself from photos. So imagine if, you know, someone posted a photo of themselves at a party and you're in the background looking awful in some stupid angle and they tag you. Facebook was considering not letting you untag yourself. And then there's this email where an executive at Facebook suggests maybe they should hold off on that. And the quote is, "If ever there was a time to avoid controversy, it would be when the world is comparing our offerings to G+, Google Plus." He suggested that they hold off on doing that, quote, "until the direct competitive comparisons begin to die down."
I.e. until Google Plus fails and we're left as the monopoly.
Exactly.
So what does the Federal Trade Commission want to do?
So both lawsuits ask for similar things. And the most dramatic form of relief that's being requested is forcing Facebook to divest itself or otherwise spin off WhatsApp and Instagram. And they ask that Facebook be enjoined and restrained from essentially that the court say, all the stuff you've been doing, you can't do it anymore. And they also want to force Facebook to have to report any proposed mergers to the states before they happen. There's no direct mechanism in this lawsuit that will affect Facebook's privacy policies. However, indirectly, the argument you could make is if competition is restored to this market, now suppose Facebook is forced to get rid of Instagram. Now, at least you've got these two platforms competing with each other. And if I don't like Facebook's privacy policy, maybe Instagram has a better one.
Now, I imagine that this isn't the only case against big tech companies, given what you've just said.
No, far from it. So before the Facebook case was filed, the Department of Justice launched an antitrust case against Google based on its alleged anti-competitive tactics to maintain its monopoly in search. And that's only one of several cases against Google. I'm very curious to see if the net widens next year to also bring in the other Apple and Amazon.
Do you think they will?
Yes.
Gillard Edelman, to understand the context in which US anti-monopoly laws operate, how a free market society decided it needed to rein in some of its most successful companies, it helps to know some history. So the Briefing Room's Viv Jones spoke to Scott Hempel, Professor of Law at the University of New York.
In the late 1800s, we saw a dramatic increase in the scale of enterprise, the rise of manufacturing. And of course, this growth brought progress and all of its blessings, but also a lot of displacement of existing firms, and with it, opportunities for abuse by these major companies as they grew. One of the first industries to achieve large scale is the railroads. You know, they got so big so fast, they, in some instances, quickly dwarfed the size of the governments that were meant on a state-by-state basis to regulate them. You would have a railway company in Boston that was, you know, several times the size of the Massachusetts government. And this created some major issues. First, these railroads had a natural tendency to want to combine and enter into arrangements that would eliminate competition between them. And then second, these powerful entities were in a position to pick and choose among their customers, favor some of them against others in ways that were discriminatory and, you know, ultimately thwarted competition, not just among the railroads, but also among the railroads' customers.
These large combined businesses were known as trusts. They were separate corporations in theory, managed under the same entity and controlled by the same people. And they were all the rage.
These trusts emerged in oil and cotton, whiskey, sugar, tobacco.
As these trusts grew, so did antitrust sentiment.
The public came to hate them. Partly there was a question of price, but also there was just a question of oppression and unfairness. And so there was a need for some kind of new law that would handle this national problem.
The result was the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890, named after its principal author, Senator John Sherman. He argued that liberty itself was at stake, declaring on the Senate floor,
"If we would not submit to an emperor, we should not submit to an autocrat of trade with power to prevent competition and to fix the price of any commodity."
The Sherman Act prohibited restraints of trade, agreements between companies to fix prices or avoid competition, and it banned monopolization.
The signal achievement of the Sherman Act in the early days was the 1911 breakup of Standard Oil. Standard Oil was the dominant oil refiner of the day. It was a firm built through merger and in part through predatory tactics by John D. Rockefeller. For his efforts, he was handsomely rewarded, you know, ultimately becoming the richest man in the world at one point. The Standard was in trouble for two main kinds of things. So first, getting special treatment from the railroads, often secretly. They would get secret rebates on their oil shipments that lowered their prices relative to what rivals had access to. And second, going to competing refineries and basically making them a buy or bury kind of offer. We could either buy you or we can bury you by cutting price so much that you're driven out of business.
The attack on Standard Oil came right from the top, from Trust Buster-in-Chief, President Theodore Roosevelt, who brought dozens of antitrust suits.
"The principles for which we stand are the principles of fair play and a square deal for every man and every woman in the United States. A square deal politically, a square deal in matters social and industrial."
Roosevelt had an interestingly nuanced view of capitalism. His goal was not to destroy capitalism, but to bring it to heel, to make sure that it didn't, you know, color outside the lines, if you will. And, you know, from that standpoint, Standard Oil was perhaps an ideal target.
It took 5 years for Roosevelt to win his suit in the Supreme Court, which broke up Standard Oil into 34 independent companies.
Don't cry too much for Rockefeller. Indeed, Rockefeller and other shareholders in Standard Oil became even wealthier following the breakup.
Over the coming decades, enthusiasm for antitrust enforcement waxed and waned. In the 1970s and 80s, there was a sea change in thinking about antitrust interventions, driven partly by the rise of free market ideas.
The market will solve the problem because the opportunity for the next generation to thrive will just be so large and compelling that somebody's going to jump in and fill this void. You know, monopoly is temporary. The next generation will arrive and displace the earlier one. The natural consequence of a belief that markets will self-regulate is a less felt need to engage in antitrust enforcement.
Over the last 50 years, American courts have seen relatively few antitrust cases. Now, with so much attention focused on the size and enduring power of big tech firms, that could be about to change.
One of the things that makes thinking about antitrust law so fun and fascinating is the need to think about these old cases and apply them to new facts. So, you know, the history of antitrust law is largely about commodities, like oil and steel and tobacco. And of course, today's cases are about information, you know, data, privacy. And so the challenge and source of uncertainty for all of us to think about antitrust law is how well and how we adapt these existing tools to these new challenges.
Scott Hempel speaking to Viv Jones. So what now for Facebook and big tech? How will the tools adapt to them? And not just in America. In the EU, fines have already been imposed on Silicon Valley companies, and the mood music is of more action to come. Joining me are Lena Khan, Associate Professor of Law at the University of Columbia, who wrote the groundbreaking paper Amazon's Antitrust Paradox, and Ariel Ezrachi, Professor of Competition Law at the University of Oxford. Lena Khan, have we come to all this rather late? I mean, it's taken a very short time for a very few players to dominate a new but really important market, and the rest of us are just way behind. Is that a good summary of where we are?
I think it's right that, you know, in the early 2000s, leading up to really just a few years ago, these tech monopolies were really allowed to acquire and maintain power through all sorts of business practices that we in previous eras would have treated as anti-competitive. And I think Facebook's acquisitions of its rivals is just one example of that. There was a sense that these are digital markets, they're fast moving, they're dynamic. If there are going to be concentrations of power, they'll quickly be competed away because everything's just so fast moving. And what we instead saw that, you know, some of these firms are now coming up towards 20 years of being dominant, if not close to dominant. So yes, I think it's fair to say that we're just now catching up.
Ariel, in that context, can you tell me why you think the Facebook case is so significant? I mean, is it really the first major example of what you think is going to come?
Well, it's not the first major example, but it is a very significant case in the overall evolution of antitrust enforcement and competition law enforcement. Especially in the US, there has been for a long while this assumption that the market will self-correct. And every time that you saw an enforcement action here in the EU, it often came with criticism from the US, arguing that the EU is over-intervening because, after all, just let the amazing power of the market resolve the problem and avoid any government intervention. And what we have seen in the past couple of months in terms of enforcement actions is a gradual departure from that assumption. And in that respect, Facebook is important.
Lena, what is Facebook's defense?
I think we're going to see what Facebook's counterarguments are in the response that it files to the complaints. I mean, I think what we've seen so far, Facebook says that, first of all, they're not a monopoly. They face all sorts of competition from companies ranging from Snap to TikTok. They also have been saying that the U.S. enforcers effectively approved these acquisitions. That's not technically right. When the Federal Trade Commission declines to challenge a deal, that it does not amount to approval. They kind of always reserve the right to go back. And in the letters that they sent to Facebook back in, 2012, 2014, they explicitly said, we reserve the right to challenge this later if need be. But what Facebook is saying, it's been close to a decade since we acquired Instagram. Is this going to start some kind of precedent where the U.S. goes around challenging 10-year-old deals? And if so, what's that going to mean for business certainty? Another argument they make is that the success of Instagram and WhatsApp was not guaranteed, and that, in fact, it was investments from Facebook that allowed these companies to thrive.
Now, one of the things that is notable here is what appears to be a significant change in the political environment, and to a certain extent, the change in public opinion in the US in terms of the market self-regulating in the way that you were talking about, Ariel. I mean, is that an elite perception, or is it actually a true perception of how people are changing their views?
Oh, people are certainly changing their views. And I think you can look at it from two angles. One is to appreciate that competition law as a discipline is, after all, a social policy. It is a reflection of the political process. And the way the U.S. regime evolved has led, I would say, to a gradual narrowing of its scope and really a light touch approach when it came to market power. But in parallel to that, what you had is rising inequality in the US. You had the feeling among many people that the competitive process, the great American dream, is not really delivering on quite a lot of fronts.
Lena, do you see it that way as well?
What we've seen in the United States is rising concentration across the economy, right? So we're talking about the Facebook case, we're talking about digital platforms, but in the US, increasingly markets are just dominated by a very small number of players in some instances, two or even fewer, even one. And this is true, in all sorts of markets in healthcare, rental cars, and that's had a set of very harmful effects, right? It's raised prices. There's research showing that it's led wages to stagnate. It's contributed to declining rates of new business formation, right? Innovation has dropped. So I think this is increasingly a systemic problem. What we've seen with the dominant platforms in the digital markets, especially Facebook and Google, because they intermediate information and communication, people understand that these are not just economic actors, but that the decisions that they're making in some ways are fundamentally political and affect things like distribution of information in the United States. And I think now we're seeing fundamental questions being asked regarding unaccountable power. There have been some remarkable polls done over the last couple of years showing that upwards of 60% of Americans now view government intervention in these markets as desirable. Public perception has significantly shifted.
Ariel, how far has the EU and the US been aligned on regulating companies like Google and Facebook up until now?
So it is a very dynamic and evolving environment. The EU, to begin with, tended to be much more interventionist when it came to regulating market power. So the EU Commission looked at the behavioral aspect that impact on us and how Google is able to sometimes manipulate us or create friction. In the US, at the same time, the analysis was very much a traditional analysis that would assume that these elements will have very little impact on competitors, on entry, on the process and the intensity of competition. And then we had other cases here in the EU that also triggered quite a lot of criticism. We had a case in Germany, the Bundeskartellamt. This is the German competition agency against Facebook dealing with privacy that raised a lot of criticism around the world on why is a competition agency trying to protect privacy.
Nina, what do you think?
I do think one place in which we do still differ is the question of remedies. And this is a, I think, ongoing topic of discussion, looking at how effective the European Commission's remedies in the Google cases actually were. And I think there is growing agreement that in many cases, the remedies failed, right? They failed to restore competition. I think there's an opportunity now for the United States to learn from some of those mistakes. Interestingly, all five of the complaints in the US that have been filed collectively against Facebook and Google request structural relief as part of the remedy. Now, structural relief basically means types of breakups. And so I think that's quite significant. We haven't seen the US government request breakups since the Microsoft case, in which it ultimately failed. The court, you know, rejected the breakup remedy in the end. In the European Commission, you know, we're still seeing, I think, a greater preference for regulatory regimes and for remedies that are really trying to effectively regulate rather than to restructure power or break up the power.
Let's zero in on what the remedies are in the EU regulatory case and what difference would they actually make to a business which is overwhelmingly based in the United States.
So the toolbox that is available in Europe includes also structural remedies. So a behavioral remedy would be, for example, to tell Facebook, stop doing whatever it is that you're doing, impose a fine. And a structural remedy would be, for example, to tell Facebook to break up parts of the organization. It's important to appreciate that there is, of course, a political dimension here. It can be much easier for US authorities to move ahead with breaking up a US company. It might be much more politically toxic for a European enforcer to do so. But the reality is, an attempt to break up national champions in the US would have resulted in immense political friction. It is absolutely true that the remedies that were used in the past have been largely ineffective. And this is because those companies benefit from very deep pockets. When you find them, even if those numbers sound immense and really significant to us, for those companies, they are completely insignificant.
Sorry, Arian, are you essentially saying that the problem is we can never, the Europeans can never find them enough money?
In essence, yes.
Lena, let's put a counter-argument to the desire for significant regulation or even breakups, which is that these are very successful companies, that they have themselves been major innovators, and that if you don't have them, then in that case, you'll just have someone from China doing the same thing.
So I don't think anybody is denying that Apple, Amazon, Facebook, and Google have been enormously successful, that at least in their early years, they were enormously innovative. What we've seen with each of these firms, especially with Facebook and Google, is that at key moments when they faced threats to their dominance, they acted in defensive ways that really tried to squash their rivals. And the goal has been to ensure, again, that the next wave of innovative companies are actually allowed to emerge and thrive. I think it'll be interesting to see the direction in which China goes. I think what we've seen in the last few weeks is that China also is introducing its own anti-monopoly rules with regards to its tech giants. So I think this dichotomy where we could risk, you know, having a very interventionist approach in the US and a totally non-interventionist approach in China, I don't think that's what the reality is actually shaping out to be.
I have a final question to put to both of you, which is, do you think that what is going on now will lead to the breakup of Facebook, Lena?
I think it very well could. But I do think that the Facebook case is somewhat unique, both in terms of the fact that these were acquisitions that Facebook made that were anti-competitive, and so undoing those acquisitions may be more palatable to a court than issuing a breakup when growth has been purely internal. And I think the range of harms now is so broad that we're seeing from Facebook's monopolistic position that a breakup may be warranted.
But even if you will not see a structural breakup, you could and very likely see separation, data breakup. So you could engage in remedies that will not be as distinct and forceful, but could try and remedy some of the problems that we see. In terms of what is the actual effect of that, it could really change the competitive landscape. Because if you have other service providers that are independent, they could then engage in different types of innovation, start to create parallel services to Facebook, start investing in different value that they offer us as consumers. We can have social networks that give us greater privacy, greater transparency, and that can have a massive change on the landscape of competition.
Ariel Ezrachi there with Lena Khan. And my conclusion is that it feels like the ground has shifted and tech companies now have the choice of acting to get ahead of the backlash or facing action. How effective that action is or what the side effects may be, that remains to be seen. My thanks to Gilad Edelman, Scott Hempel, Viv Jones, Lena Khan and Ariel Ezrachi. We'll be back next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Vivian Jones and Serena Tarling. The programme was mixed by Gareth Jones and the editor was Jasper Corbett. And if you found this episode interesting, there's quite a library now of Briefing Room podcasts dealing in everything from the pandemic and Brexit to the treatment of the Uyghurs and the effect of meat eating on the environment. They're all on BBC Sounds. And there'll be another one along soon in 2021.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.